The White House declares the opioid crisis a national health emergency. What that might mean for the First Coast and our local crisis just ahead. Good morning and happy Halloween. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9, and you can always get our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or through our app. Just ahead, how the opiate crisis is affecting the First Coast and some programs being used to get patients help that they need. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, former Fox News anchor and author Gretchen Carlson talks about her new book, Be Fierce, and the movement she's become the face of fighting harassment in the workplace. Plus, it's our new movable feast on the show as we drop in on Dennis Chan from Jacksonville's local favorite, Blue Bamboo. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, President Trump is in the news this week for a number of reasons, one of which, of course, is the burgeoning Russia investigation. You've heard a lot about that on our radio station all throughout the morning. But right now on this program, we're going to talk about another issue, the opioid epidemic. The president last week declared it a national health emergency and asked Congress to authorize more funding for states and cities to combat it. Now, many cities like Jacksonville are facing severe financial problems due to this crisis as the number of overdoses strain budgets of fire and rescue departments and medical examiners' offices. And that includes right here in Duval County, where we are seeing enormous problems with that. There are organizations and health facilities out there working to get more people off highly addictive opioids and related medications. One of them is Jacksonville's Center for the Healthy Mind and Well-Being. We're going to take a look at their approach and discuss the national response to the opioid crisis as we welcome the center's Dr. Marcus DiCarvalho to Studio 5. Dr. DiCarvalho, it's a pleasure to have you. Dr. D, as your patients call you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I somewhat mangled your last name,
as
I want to do with a lot of people. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the White House declaring the opioid crisis a national health emergency. What are your questions about this? What are your thoughts? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can weigh in on Facebook as well. And of course, any presidential administration has to focus on many things at once. And this is one of them. The CDC has classified the opioid crisis in the U.S. an epidemic. The White House has weighed in and called it a national health emergency. As a local specialist on addiction, first off, doctor, what's your response to this? Do you think this will make a difference when it comes to combating this crisis in the United States?
Well, I think, you know, definitely it will make a difference. Any type of support will definitely bring awareness. But without allocating the funds to really train people well, physicians, to train them well on addiction and what is out there as far as addiction treatment, nothing's going to change. One of the things we do on a daily basis in my private offices is really educate our patients why it is that they are stuck doing the things that they don't want to do. And often they will come to me and tell me, I don't want to continue to live this life. I don't want to continue to do this, but why do I continue to do it? And one of the things I do, and what I brought here for you today, Melissa, is a slide presentation, three simple slides that I show my patients really to educate them that why they are stuck. So essentially what happens is we have evolved as human beings to experience pleasure out of things that keep us alive. We eat a meal, we feel good. We sleep, we feel good. We even have sex, and that allows for us to have a human race, and it feels good. So we continue these behaviors. Now, there is a chemical associated with this, and it's called dopamine. And the media has given a lot of attention to dopamine as this reward chemical that causes addiction, but it has a much deeper role. And here is the thing. When dopamine is released, it creates new neurons in the brain, which is called neuroplasticity. Those neurons are specific for the food you take, the music you're listening to at the time, the person you're with, the emotions, the feelings, the environment. Everything associated with it is laid down in those neurons. And the more you do it, you strengthen those neurons and they become your go-to. And then we try to recreate that. Honey, let's go to our favorite place to eat. We love that place. We try to recreate that feeling of goodness. But when you introduce a drug like an opioid that produces 1,000 more times dopamine than food, sleep, or sex, you will start to lay down new neurons specific for that drug. And the brain now believes it needs that drug to survive, like food or sleep. And we use the term in my office, the brain becomes hijacked. Now, I showed this slide for you here to see. This is the creation of new neurons. I'm showing a slide that has neurons being created from left to right here. Look at this neural network. This is all specific for, where do I buy that heroin? How do I lie about that heroin? I want to get high with my friends. How do I do this? How do I have this double life? And people are stuck in this because of these neurons that are created.
And what I'm looking at is, as I look at your slide, doctor, from left to right, it's like looking at, on the left side, I see a few little dots. And then as I slide over to the right, I see this really dense pattern of lines and dots. So a whole new brain mapping is taking place where your brain, it looks like, is literally being rewired to obsessively focus on nothing but getting more of this drug. And is that right?
That's exactly it. And so the other thing we try to do is we try to teach our patients, okay, what is it about you as an individual that could put you at higher risk for an addiction? So we look at the biological. What does their DNA say? Did their parents struggle with addiction? Also biologically, are they actively being prescribed medications that are addictive in nature by their dentist, by their pain medicine doctor? Psychologically, what happened to them in their development? Were they sexually abused? Were they brought up in the foster care system where there may have been abuse? Did they have both parents available? And now as adults, they're dealing with the pain and hurts and they have found, hey, take an extra Percocet or a Lortab here and I could just dull that pain. And they're using that system. And socially, what's going on in their lives? Who is involved in their lives? Who is their social network? Their culture of friends? Are their friends using drugs all the time and get away with it? Are they actively involved, say, in ministry work or church work? What is going on financially in their life? Are they under a lot of stress? Are they about to lose their job? And they have found by going home and taking a few of these pills that are sitting in a bottle that were prescribed way back when their wisdom teeth were taken out, and they can dull the pain. So we look at these three things and we say, so if you have each one of these as a probable factor, you most likely will develop an addiction. But we studied those people that don't actually have any of those, that don't have any genetics, that socially they're doing great, and psychologically they've had a great development. And you know what? If they use, one use alone can develop a full-blown addiction as well. So nobody can escape it. So the more we educate our clients and our patients what is going on the brain, it helps them understand that there is an actual war. Now, when I talk about this stuff, it sounds like, well, there's no hope. But there actually is hope. What I'm talking about is that once you've introduced this to your brain and you've developed that neuroplasticity, you are going to be vulnerable to this addiction for life. But the hope lies here, Melissa, right in the front of the brain. The front of the brain is responsible for your right and wrong, your values. What is important to you? Why do you want treatment? Why do you want to be sober? How do you want to function as a father, a mother, or an employee? The hope lies in that area. And if we strengthen that area in the front of the brain, and that area is stronger than this area where the brain reward pathway takes place, we call that sobriety. Mm-hmm. But once you let this area of the brain go and you don't work on your addiction daily, and this becomes stronger, we call that relapse. And this is why people come and say, why do I continue to do the things I don't want to do? If they are targeted and they are directed in a way that they focus on this and they're given the education, they are given the skills, they are given the coping mechanisms, they have a chance. But if not, and I sincerely say this to my clients, if not, they will pass away eventually over time. The the opioids that are out there today are not just regular Percocet or Lortab. They are laced with fentanyl, 100 times more powerful than morphine, and carfentanil, 100 times more powerful than fentanyl.
The bodies are piling up at the morgue faster than the medical examiner can literally process them. JFRD, they're responding to call after call so quickly that the Jacksonville City Council now is preparing to literally file a lawsuit suing the opiate manufacturers in the same way that governments sued big tobacco a couple of decades ago. We want your calls on this, 549-2937. Okay, so Dr. D, as you said, we need education and a way of treatment that really is what you're arguing is a fundamental paradigm shift in the way we look at addiction and recovery. Now, as the president has declared this a public health emergency, by the way, he did not call this a national emergency. That is something that is generally only done after a major natural disaster, like a hurricane.
Correct.
He called this a public health emergency, and he has directed the government to use every appropriate emergency authority to fight this crisis and end this epidemic. More than 64,000 people died last year from drug overdoses in America. Most of those were linked to opioids, oxycodone, fentanyl, heroin. The CDC has found that these deaths have soared 200%. Between 2000 and 2014. And Trump's declaration will allow the hiring of more personnel, things like telemedicine services, prescribing of treatments to treat addiction, more grant money and such. Do you think that this is an adequate response? Do you think this will help? Because a minute ago you said this requires a fundamental change in the way we view how the brain is responding to this deadly and highly addictive drug. And it your approach is a very forward-looking approach to treatment and recovery. And it's not one that everyone has adopted. We need to be clear on that.
Correct. So what I have basically done is I've created a website called untanglingaddiction.com. And on that website, what I'm going to do is basically provide the information that I've just given you here as far as education, but also educate families, people who are struggling with addiction, and loved ones. But this is not a moral failure. This is not just a behavioral issue. Yes, there was a behavior that took place where somebody made a bad decision and now they're stuck. But this is actually a medical disease. There are brain changes that are taking place in this person's brain that now cannot be reversed and they are stuck. But there is treatment out there. There is actual hope that they can go after this. And if we continue to educate, okay, people will have a shot. Now, here's the thing. It is great that President Trump did what he did. The CDC has called this an epidemic for years. What are epidemics? The Ebola virus, okay? People are dying. It is a national emergency. This is not just in Jacksonville. This is all over the country, okay? A quarter of high school students by the end of this year will have used opioids to get high. If you go online, you will find chat forums where teenagers are excited to see their dentist to get their wisdom teeth taken out because they will get to use opioids. That is alarming. Because what happens if one of those kids, they take one with their dentist, they feel safe, then they go out to a party and somebody gives them a Percocet, but it has fentanyl, and they die. That's a reality. So the more we educate and the more we tell them, look, this is what happens. People are actually passing away. This is not just a heroin addict in Greenwich Village from the 60s and 70s. This is today.
Yeah. And so once you start the process then of untangling addiction in your practice, you educate. But how do you treat? What's the treatment protocol at your office?
So essentially, I engage my patients and I tell them, look, there's nothing you're going to tell me. There's nothing you're going to do that's going to frazzle me or make me give up on you. I do perform urine drug screens when they come in every time. In order to engage the patient, look, yes, your urine drug screen is going to be positive. Most practitioners will find a positive urine drug screen and kick the patient out of their practice. But it's an opportunity for me to engage and say, okay, let's dig deeper here and what's going on. What is the underlying reason that you're using? We talked about developmental issues, social issues.
So you're doing cognitive therapy.
We also do
talk therapy.
Cognitive, and we also do mindfulness. Mindfulness is another form of behavioral therapy where we actually train the client how to hold lightly to these feelings and emotions while they step into their life, not run or escape, which is actually a form of addiction and control, step into their life, but what is their value-based system? What is important to them? And that's where that lies in the frontal lobe. Why is it they want to be sober instead of escaping every time they get this overwhelming feeling or urge and they want to suppress it? We train them to do that.
All right, let's go to some calls now. 549-2937. Mark is in Highland, Florida. Hey, Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
My question is, I was listening to the show yesterday, and they said that the company that makes these painkillers that are so addictive is realizing that the market in the United States is drying up because people are, you know, that's all you hear is dead bodies piled so high they can't get them in the morgue. But they're going overseas and telling the people over there that they can use these things. There's this, like a sustainable method of controlling pain. They're not addictive. So why can't the government step in there and rein these dirty buggers in?
Thanks for the call, Mark.
That's a great question. In 1991, prior to 1991, we did not have the number of deaths we're seeing now. Opioids were given to people with cancer-related pain. Okay?
Severe pain.
Yes, real pain.
Yeah.
People who are dying, okay, who need relief. In 1991, there was this dramatic push by the pharmaceutical industry to create what's called the fifth vital sign. Prior to that, there were four vital signs: blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, respiratory rate. You go into an ER, they slap a blood pressure cuff on you, those are the vitals. But in 1991, the pharmaceutical industry created this fifth vital sign, and that's pain.
Pain. Yeah.
Okay, you walk into any hospital today, smiley face, sad face, what is your pain level? And physicians were trained to deal with pain aggressively. Now you can walk into a doctor's office, get opioids for migraines. There are some doctors that will give it to you for depression and anxiety.
Isn't it amazing how over and over again, good intentions invariably lead to these
Absolutely.
Hellish unintended consequences?
Absolutely. I think really the key now, though, and that was a great question. I think really the key now is for people in power, legislative power, to really bring in the authorities who are experts in this field, not just with theory, but people who are actually in front of patients daily, who are in the trenches and see what is going on. There's a photo that's out there that Time put out, which we call the photo of the opioid epidemic. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it's a grandmother and her boyfriend passed away in a car with a child
with
in the
little
back.
Kid in the it back.
That is the reality
yeah.
of this epidemic.
I think some police officers took that photo.
That's right.
That's
exactly.
Right. Okay, Peggy is in Arlington. Hello, Peggy.
Good morning. Good morning. You talk about our local legislation suing the drug companies. Well, the FDA has had their power taken away by a law enacted by the federal government. I would like you and your guests to address this and how we as citizens can get to our legislators and say, hey, that law letting the drug companies off the hook isn't going to cut it. And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Peggy, thank you.
That's a great question. So, there are organizations that I'm actually actively involved with, like Drug Free Duval and the North Florida Task Force Against Opioid Addiction. And so it's organizations like this that meet with the local legislature that untangle what are the issues going on today. This group is made up of people who are mothers, fathers, first responders, physicians, teachers, lawyers, doctors, who are all wanting to help. I would tell you to be a part of that. Go online, look up Drug Free Duval, attend the meetings. The more support we have for this, the better we have a chance at overcoming this.
What about, though, her question, though, that the FDA is getting a pass? That they have not really been held to account in approving these medications for such wide use and wide prescription, so easily available.
Okay.
What about her question?
That's
there?
A really good question. So now, when I said you can go to a physician and get an opioid for a migraine, or you can get an opioid even for depression, that is not actually approved specifically for that usage, but physicians are given the licensure to treat illnesses off-label. So if there is some data that's out there, like say, hey, there's a physician who's treating anxiety or depression with an opioid in the Northeast and it's published, but the FDA has not approved it, I can say, look, this guy is doing this over there and he's seeing some benefit. I'm going to try it here in my private practice. And that's one of the issues. It's also the physicians. Physicians need to be educated that, hey, long-term use of these medications will develop tolerance. But also, as tolerance goes up, the risk of death goes up.
Haven't doctors started to come around to this? And haven't they tightened up how much they're handing out these meds? Am I getting incorrect information here, doctor? Because I've gotten, that's what I've been told increasingly when we do this, when we touch on this topic.
Absolutely. That is absolutely true. Doctors are more aware and they are prescribing less and less, and they are referring their patients who have an addiction to specialists. I get patients all the time that other physicians have collaborated with me and said, look, this person definitely needs to be off. I want to put this person in your care. Can we wean them off? What can we do? What program do you have in place? That is true. But there also is a truth to the fact that there are still physicians out there prescribing a lot of these medications. The CDC has done a study where they look at what is the number one reason why these medications are out there. They looked at drug dealers, they looked at family friends, they looked at everything, and without a doubt, it's still physicians prescribing.
Okay. Now, you when you treat patients, you're getting deep into the core emotional issues, psychological issues. Another form of treatment that's proven effective is medication-assisted treatment, MAT. Methadone has been well known, but also another drug. I'm going to butcher this. Yeah, you can say it. You can say it.
Yes.
Say it again.
Buprenorphine naloxone.
Buprenorphine naloxone. Those substances have been effective in helping wean patients off.
Mm-hmm.
So is it your contention then that a combination holistic approach using the medication-assisted treatment in conjunction with doing this sort of cognitive therapy, deeper emotional work, that's the key?
Mm-hmm. You can't have one without the other. It's impossible. They are all, you know, as far as MAT goes, medication-assisted treatment, there's another great medicine out there called naltrexone, which is now an injectable 1 month called Vivitrol. They are excellent tools. They are a part of the treatment process, but they are not the one and only thing that's going to change somebody's life. Everything has to be a part of it. You have to understand the individual and what has happened to them, why they've developed this addiction. Yeah, they've developed the addiction and now there's brain changes going on, but what was the underlying etiology? Why did this happen? I'm a proponent for whatever it takes to treat my patients, to give them full functional lives, to have them go back and actually live again and become unstuck.
John is in Riverside this morning. John, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How's everyone doing this morning?
All right, thanks.
Good.
Excellent. I just had a sort of a comment, and I was thinking about the root reason. I understand and I appreciate a lot of the solutions being provided, but to me, these are treating the symptoms. I think that these problems will keep reoccurring. It doesn't matter what drug it is. You ban one thing, something else comes out. You do this, something else happens. Humans, by nature, are always looking to alter their perspective in many different ways. I think the real issue is the cultural, moral context of the society. And so if we want to fix these problems, why don't we address it at the school level when kids are still young? Indoctrination, training, teaching them not only about the drugs, but, you know, a little bit of shock effect in the classrooms, and adding things that allow kids to have purpose and meaning in their lives. People wonder why people are doing these things. They're bored, or they don't have any meaning or purpose, or they're you know, reacting like we've all become consumers. We're just reacting to things. To me, these are the core issues. We can try all these stopgap measures to address the symptoms of our social malaise, if you will, and the individual suffering that comes from it. But unless we address the core issues of the
thanks. Yeah, thank you.
How we raise our children, we're going to have these problems.
Thank you, John. And Bob in St. Augustine has a similar comment. Hi, Bob. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Yeah, the last caller was grazing on something that I think is not being discussed nearly enough within the process of treating addiction. And I'm not sure that it's treatable. And that is, you know, we're in a society where that's being prescribed 20 times per capita more antidepressants, anti-anxieties, and we've got this huge opioid epidemic that is coming from the stresses of society, a society that's so Darwinian that it's pull yourself up by your own bootstraps or too bad, and the stresses are so intrinsic. And we have a society that refuses to provide basic things for people like healthcare, housing, things that could lighten the load on people and reduce their sort of need to or desire to want to escape. I'm not sure that this is a fixable problem. I hate to say that, but I think that that is the case.
Okay, thank you so much for those calls.
Two fantastic questions and real questions. I have this slide up here for you, Melissa. This is a photo of my two sons here, and I have mindfulness there. And I was presenting at a conference.
And they're doing a yoga pose.
They're doing yoga poses. And I was asked to go to present at a conference on addiction in D.C., and I asked my two sons, I said, hey, this is Rafa and that's Paulo. And I said, can you guys come back with me? I want to take a picture of you. I'm going to use it in this conference. So when they went back there, I said, I want you guys to pose in these positions for something that's called mindfulness. And my wife started laughing and they got in those poses. Okay. And I look at my wife and I say, how do they know how to do that? My two sons, they go to a school called Bowles here locally, and essentially they're already teaching children in school mindfulness techniques. Why? The school system gets it. It's not just about people who are at end-stage disease, who are facing incarceration, or who are found dead. It's about our children. My children are going to be faced with somebody eventually offering them this. They're going to read about it on the internet. They're going to hear about it, and they're going to be curious. But with things like mindfulness, these different types of techniques, they will be prepared to have the ability from a cognitive perspective, a coping perspective, to make good decisions. Those questions were excellent because that is the reality of this illness. A lot of people feel that there is no hope. There is hope. But we have to get to the core of the issue. It's not just about prescribing antidepressants and anti-anxiety. I totally agree. And I'm a psychiatrist, okay? When clients come to my office, the first thing we want to understand is what has happened in their lives. What can we do from a behavioral perspective, therapy perspective? If we do need to add medications, because the research is true as far as depression and anxiety, when you take medication with therapy, the efficacy goes up from 40% to 90%. That's a big difference when somebody is struggling. But without a doubt, it has to start here. And we're talking about pre-K and first grade.
That picture of your sons is really powerful. I wish that I could share it with everyone listening right now. It's very beautiful. And this is hopefully information that is going to help a lot of people out there listening, because certainly we focus on this topic regularly on the show because it is a public health epidemic in this area and in this country. Thank you so much for coming in on short notice to share the latest on this issue with us, Dr. D. We appreciate you being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
He's Dr. Marcus D. Carvalho with the Center for a Healthy Mind and Well-Being in Jacksonville. Much more still ahead later. The upcoming TEDx talk at FSCJ. Also, it's our movable feast on the show. But up next, former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson on her new book and movement encouraging women to be fierce. That's in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Bridget Cambria was hired to counsel kids who had come to the U.S. seeking refuge. Instead,
I learned how to restrain children. I learned how to shackle children. I learned how to strip search children. All the things that you would find in a normal prison.
Why this country detains immigrant kids for months, even years, on the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, just over a year and a half ago, former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson rocked the media world when she sued late Fox News chief Roger Ailes and accused him of sexual harassment. Carlson's lawsuit emboldened other women at the network to also come forward and expose a culture of harassment at the right-leaning channel. Ailes was eventually ousted from the network he had founded. He has since passed on. Since her landmark lawsuit, Carlson has gone on to become the face of a movement focused on ending harassment in the workplace across all industries and changing our culture as well. I spoke with Carlson. She's in the middle of a book tour right now. That book is called Be Fierce, Stop Harassment and Take Your Power Back. Take a listen. Gretchen Carlson, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're in the midst of this incredible book tour right now, promoting Be Fierce, and you've really become the face of this growing movement to push back against sexual harassment. Of course, it all really crystallized when you went public with your lawsuit against your former boss, the late Roger Ailes of Fox News. This was just over a year ago, July of 2016. I remember this vividly when this hit the news that you had sued him. I know you can't talk about the specifics of that lawsuit and the everything that happened, but since that happened, when you started down this path over a year ago, I think it's safe to say you might not have realized how this was going to snowball and that you were going to become the face of this thing. What a journey it's been for you, my goodness. Did you anticipate this when it all began for you?
Absolutely not. There would be no way to predict how any of this would have unfolded. You know, after I did what I did on July 6, 2016, it was just something that took immense courage, and it's not something that I just decided overnight. So it was an excruciating choice, and I was really, you know, feeling like I was alone, and I soon found out that there were so many other women who had gone through similar indignities, and they started reaching out to me by the thousands, and I, corresponded back and forth with them, and that was really the impetus for writing the book, Be Fierce, was to tell their stories. But if you fast forward to where we are today, I mean, it's just been this amazing change in a short period of time, and cultural shifts don't happen quickly, so I think this is an incredible positive time for women to know that they have the bravery and the courage and they have people behind them to come forward now. And I don't see it ending anytime soon.
Right. More and more women are coming forward all the time. And there have just been an avalanche of stories. The shocking revelations about Harvey Weinstein, of course, have been in the news. Just this week, we're hearing new revelations about another high-profile guy in the media, Mark Halperin. It just seems never-ending. Now, as you said,
but that's a good thing. That's a good thing, though.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's. I mean, it's not good for these, you know, men who are having these stories come out about them. But it's a good thing for us as a society to finally get rid of this scourge, and it's also amazing for women and men who've had to go through this as victims, who are feeling liberated, who are feeling like their voices are finally being heard, and they're transferring the shame that they have felt for so long onto the correct place, which is on the harassers.
Sure. You and I came up in a specific culture of television news, which has long had a problem with this. But of course, as you write about in your book, this is a problem that exists across all industries and all corporate cultures, all types of businesses. Some of the stories in your book are really quite harrowing, and I would think it was really therapeutic for these women, as you said, to share these stories publicly.
It was so therapeutic for them and for me. You know, it was cathartic for me to write the book because I was still experiencing, you know, a ton of dark days and not knowing what the end result would be. And I, you know, I share stories in the book about how I was even very intimidated to go out in public because I just didn't know what the reaction would be. And for the other women who reached out to me by the thousands, the idea that I would tell their stories and give them a voice, they felt like they never had one. And it was so empowering to them as well to know that I got what they went through and that I wanted to honor them in my book, Be Fierce. So the book really came about as a result of giving voice to these women who had never been heard and also moving the needle forward, giving advice to women. I have a whole chapter called A Playbook, which is a 12-point plan if you happen to be facing this or you might face it in the workplace. I do a whole chapter on men because they're really a huge part of the equation in helping us solve this. I do a whole chapter on parenting because that is where this really starts. How do we raise our boys and girls with gender equality and respect so that we eradicate the issue before men and women turn into whatever they do, before they get into the workplace?
Right. You really are quite vocal about that, about bringing men into this discussion as allies and trying to empower men to speak out about this. What are some ways that men can do that and not just be bystanders, men that are listening to this conversation right now, men that are sympathetic to this? How would you challenge men to become part of this movement?
Well, thank you so much for asking, because it really is the crucial part of the equation. So the Be Fierce movement, the book that I always have said is really more of a movement. It's essential that we try to turn men from being enablers, because that normalizes sexual harassment within the confines of the corporate structure. When men are enablers, and women, when they don't speak up and tell the harasser, hey, we don't stand for that here, then it normalizes inside the company. And then you move on to the next step, and it becomes acceptable. So that's the first thing, to stop being enablers, please. And then to muster up the same amount of courage that it might take for a woman or a man to come forward if they're being harassed, in the same way, find the courage to not be a bystander, to care that this is happening in your company potentially, and to stand up for the woman or man who comes forward and says, this happened to me. And that will be the central way in which we change the dynamic going on within the corporate culture, is when we start having the other people, not just the victims, who get the courage, but the other people to say, I saw it, or she told me when this happened. And that will be the true tipping point within companies, where it won't just be talked about in social media, but that actual change will happen inside the company.
Sure. You also have really practical advice in your book for women and men going through this. Simple advice, like document your experiences. Document everything. That's a good piece of advice.
Yeah.
And that's something clearly that you did when you were going through your ordeal.
It's essential to make sure that you write down everything. I mean, I even advocate people keeping a journal and being really precise. I give an example in Chapter 4 in the playbook. I lay out exactly how you would do this. And then the most important piece of that is to bring it home. You know, you don't want to keep that in the office. I talked to countless women who had kept, you know, precise records, but then if they were retaliated against or fired as a result of coming forward, they couldn't go back to their office to get it. So the real crucial thing is to bring it home. Mm. And then also, really, the first point is to call a lawyer. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's sometimes the policies and the way in which you're supposed to report things within the workplace are not always completely beneficial to you. So you want to make sure you call a lawyer first, just to tell he or she what's happening and see what their advice is.
And that's Gretchen Carlson, one of the featured speakers this week at the TED Women 2017 conference in New Orleans. Her book is called Be Fierce. Here in Jacksonville, you can take part in a simulcast event direct from the TED stage in the Big Easy. The evening on the FSCJ Kent campus will include a panel of dynamic local speakers. We've got a preview from Lisa Everly, board president at the Women's Center of Jacksonville, and TEDx FSCJ student Catherine Sands. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Lisa, let's start with you. This is going to be a simulcast of the big TED event happening over in New Orleans. What's going to be happening here in town?
Well, it's a great and exciting event because it's going to be a couple of things. We're going to have the simulcast followed by a panel discussion. And this whole thing is about raising women out of poverty or bridges out of poverty, which is so timely for what we're doing here in Jacksonville with the Women's Giving Alliance having a grant focus in that area and all of the panelists being grant recipients from WGA in their effort to raise women out of poverty.
Very nice. Catherine Sands, a great panel. You've got the CEO of Changing Homelessness, the head of the Women's Center, Gail Payton from Hubbard House, as Lisa mentioned, Women's Giving Alliance. This is something that people can come and listen to the live panel, but they can also watch the simulcast of the TED event as well?
Yes, they can. We're going to have the simulcast and then the discussion. And we have an amazing set of panelists.
Yeah, it will be. In fact, it's kind of interesting because there are, I believe, a half dozen different bridge topics. And we will not know until the night of which one that we will be using for that. But all of them are on traversing bridges, building bridges, tearing down bridges. So it'll be interesting. It'll be kind of exciting for the panel because we won't be certain which simulcast we'll have access to until the night of
The night of.
Right.
So it'll be a surprise.
Yes,
kind
for
of
all
interesting.
Of us.
And so when people learn about this topic, how gender intersects with poverty, that's a complicated topic and one that is kind of tough to talk about here in the few minutes we have. But if you can, give us a short preview into what people might learn about when they come out to this event.
Well, one of the exciting things that will happen is there will be a woman there with a lived experience. Shanita Jones will be speaking about her specific lived experience here in Jacksonville of a woman who has been raised out of poverty using the programs and services that are available to her. And then our hope and our expectation is that the audience will be better informed about what resources do exist to help women in Northeast Florida who do experience a life of poverty and how to break out of that cycle of poverty.
That's the good news. There are some resources available. People just need to be connected to them, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is one of the challenges that we always have is making people aware of what is available, whether it's word of mouth or things like the United Way's 211 program of referral and resource. But all of the agencies do tend to pull together and refer. If a woman comes and they cannot serve her, they will refer her to appropriate resources.
Now, FSCJ for several years now has been doing these TEDx events. What's that been like for the campus?
I think it's great for the campus. It opens a dialogue to things that people wouldn't have been exposed to otherwise. And it's Paul Hendrickson's baby. Like, TEDx, FSCJ is something that he created and something that he runs
with. Is he a professor at the school?
Yes, he's a speech professor.
Yeah. And TED stands for, I think it's Technology, Entertainment, and Design. But what it is are these video talks that get viewed millions of times all over the world. And if you're asked to give a TED talk, and it takes off, a lot of people are going to get to see it. And
right.
So when you go to a TED conference, you get to participate in being part of something where people that have some dynamic ideas are presenting their ideas in a video format. And it's a really interesting exchange of ideas. I guess that's the easiest way to put this.
It is. And what's so great about this is the ability to not have to go to New Orleans and spend quite a bit of money to participate. So, you know, all of us who are big fans of TED programming on YouTube and other, access points really appreciate the fact that we can access those same great discussions.
Right. So if you like the TED movement and TED Talks, this is your chance to be part of TED without leaving home because TEDx FSCJ is presenting a salon this Thursday night at 6:30 p.m. on the FSCJ Kent campus, room F128, there on Roosevelt Boulevard in Jacksonville. It's a direct simulcast event of the TED Women 2017 conference in New Orleans, but it will also include a panel of local speakers. So come on out for this Thursday evening, and thanks for this preview. So great to speak to you both. Lisa Everly, she's board president at the Women's Center of Jacksonville. Student Catherine Sands with FSCJ. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Hope you have a great time. And in a moment, it's our movable feast as we drop in on Dennis Chan of Blue Bamboo.
Robert Mueller's investigation has entered a new phase. The special counsel's decision to charge President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and Rick Gates, who worked with Manafort, adds to the growing controversy. And for many, it might add to the confusion. What we do know and what we don't know about the latest developments regarding the Russia investigation. Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Groff. He stars in the new Netflix series Mindhunter. He played King George in Hamilton, was the voice of the Iceman and his reindeer in the film Frozen, had a recurring role in Glee, starred in the musical Spring Awakening, and starred in the recent HBO series Looking, about a group of gay friends. Lots to talk about and listen to. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
The logic behind the estate tax goes a little something like this.
The United States is not an aristocracy. That we don't want to have generation upon generation of assets build up untaxed.
Ah, that it was so easy. I'm Kai Rizdahl, the case for and against the estate tax, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, he is the lovable and talented local chef known for his hip Asian comfort food. In today's Movable Feast, our regular look at dining and hospitality trends around town, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance talks with executive chef Dennis Chan of the Southside Eatery, Blue Bamboo.
Banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato.
You've been here in Jacksonville for more than 13 years, leading the charge with Blue Bamboo. Can you share a little bit about your history and how you ended up here in Jacksonville?
Sure. I was born and raised here in Jacksonville. And although Blue Bamboo has only been around for 13 years, my family's been in the restaurant business here in Jacksonville for over 80 years.
80 years from where?
From my grandfather, who came over in the U.S. Army from Canton, China, over to New York and then down to Florida. He chose Jacksonville because the climate is the closest to what he knew back where he was from.
That's amazing. 80 years ago. So in the 1940, during World War II?
Yes, during World War II, he came over in the Army and then settled in Jacksonville. And my family has had 13 restaurants here in town since I've been
around.
That's
an unbelievable number. So how long did your grandfather wave the baton and then pass it on to whom? To your father?
To my uncle.
To your uncle.
And then my other uncle had restaurants and parents. My mother also had restaurants.
So. And was everybody a Chan? Like a Dennis Chan?
Ng is our family name Ng. From that side of the family.
Okay, and
what inspired you to continue in everybody's footsteps?
Well, I felt like I had this legacy to follow. And so after graduating college, I decided to go to culinary school. And I wanted to do it right. So I went to, without seeing the school or the campus, I went to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. And I wanted to learn a little bit about how to run a successful restaurant. So I worked for a restaurant company for 5 years before I decided to open Blue Bamboo.
So for 13 years, you've had one of the most wonderful, delicious Asian restaurants. Can you describe your cuisine? Now, don't forget, we're on the radio. I wish we could see photos of the gorgeous food and smell it, but now you have to describe it, your style of cooking.
Well, we'll paint you a picture. What we cook is called hip Asian comfort food, and it is all the flavors that is comfort food to you, but presented in a new and just a visually delicious way. One of our signature dishes is our red curry shrimp and grits. And
now that really says it, red curry shrimp and grits. So I hear the hip Asian comfort food right in that dish. Go ahead, tell us about
that. Oh, yes. Well, you know, along our coast, we have shrimp and grits is pretty popular. So we've taken an Asian spin on it. We first take our grits, our slow-cooked grits, and make them into a patty. We panko bread them and fry them, and then serve them with a classic red curry shrimp stir fry on top.
You know, the first thing I think about when I enjoy Asian cooking and dining is sake. And being from a cold city, New York, whenever it was a winter day and or an evening and I would have sake, it was always served hot, and it was so comforting to me. I looked forward to it, and I always thought it brought out the aroma and the taste warm. Here, I see people drinking, like when I was in your restaurant last week, they were drinking sake, and it looked like it was chilled. Talk about sake and what we should know.
Sure. Well, we at Blue Bamboo have Jacksonville's best selection of cold sakis, and sake has grades. Different grades of sake are different qualities of sake. So the higher the grade, the more you can drink it cold. And what determines a grade of sake is how much of the impurities are shaved off of each grain of rice before it's brewed. Yes.
So when you serve sake at Blue Bamboo, is it in a wine glass or in the little cup?
We have little cups that are clear, and it's just a beautiful way of enjoying sake with your meal. Like everything on our menu is cooked to order. So we decided as we remodeled our restaurant that we should rebuild the restaurant as if we were to build a brand new restaurant, but in the same space. So part of that is adding our new menu item, and we call it our Creation Bowls, and you can pick whatever ingredients you would like in this, and then we cook it just as you request with whatever sauce you'd like.
Hip Asian comfort food. I can't imagine anything more delicious on a daily diet. Dennis Chan, Blue Bamboo, thank you for being on Movable Feast, brought to you by 927 Events here in Jacksonville. And I am coming in for lunch and sake. Thanks.
Can't wait to see you.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
And that's our show. Happy Halloween, everybody. Have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.